Democrats may be banking on a blue wave this year, but statewide candidates don't seem to have embraced their most rural voters and their seemingly untapped potential. President Donald Trump has been on the road to make sure no Republican stone is left unturned, and he was in Mesa Friday to rally support across the state for Martha McSally and Doug Ducey. And while there's still time to vote for your favorite candidates, there's at least one you shouldn't bother voting for at all. And we're not biased, it's just the facts. You're listening to The Breakdown. Hey there, podcast listeners. I'm your guest host, Ben Giles, back at it this week with Carmen Foreman and Katie Campbell. We're starting today off with a topic that is near and dear to Katie's heart, rural voters. More specifically, rural Democrats who have been on her mind these last few weeks. If you followed our coverage of Red for Ed earlier this year, you may remember Katie spoke to a few teachers out in rural communities who said they felt left behind to some degree by that movement. And what Katie found last week was that this is nothing new. Both parties, but Democrats in particular, have either misunderstood or just straight up neglected rural Arizonans. But what's interesting about that is that more than one expert said the divide between rural and urban Democrats can often be bigger than the partisan divide. So when statewide candidates don't get out there, those votes go unharvested. Katie, why aren't those votes being harvested?
Well, if you read my story last week, you know that nothing I talked about was rocket science or particularly new to this election cycle. But the reality of that rural-urban divide is that it has to compete with a harsher reality of the arithmetic of statewide elections. A lot of candidates can pick up a lot more votes in the city than maybe our residents living in certain rural communities. So spending a ton of time in these rural areas in Mojave County and Santa Cruz County and Greenlee County may not pay off in the numbers game. What's interesting, though, is that you have to consider closer races. Take, for example, the superintendent of public instruction race, which I fully anticipate is going to be a very, very close win, either for Hoffman or Riggs. So if you pay attention to those rural areas, you stand the chance of harvesting votes that maybe would have gone untapped otherwise that really could swing it one way or the other. The thing is, not every race is a close call, so not a lot of candidates actually take the time to build that into their strategy.
So I guess why might a candidate then decide to court that couple hundred or a few thousand rural votes that, as you said, you know, we've had districts that were decided by votes in the tens, not like the hundreds, the tens. When do you make that calculus that it's worth it to take a little bit of my time to reach out to voters in the far reaches of the state?
I think it's hard to say, and there's no clear answer to that question. And that's kind of what makes it difficult to navigate that challenging arithmetic, that challenging decision about when it will pay off to go to these rural areas. I spoke to Dave Tunnell, who has been a Mojave County Democrat for the last 18 years. If you know anything about Mojave County, you know that's a very difficult position to be in. He's in a very, very red county, and he fully recognizes that the chances of them even getting a countywide Democrat are slim to none. But his thoughts are, if these candidates do pay more attention, if they come out there and they talk, they knock on doors and they talk to voters and they really actually try to understand what makes a rural voter tick, then that voter talks to their neighbor and that neighbor talks to their neighbor. And that neighbor maybe calls another family member who owns a ranch over in Graham County. And next thing you know, you've got a word of mouth game. So I think that's kind of where you have to figure it into your cost benefit analysis, is not just considering a rural voter as a single vote you're possibly picking up, but that rural voter's potential to gain you the trust of others as well.
I maintain that if you want to switch somebody, there's nothing better, first of all, than looking in the eye. And if you can't look them in the eye, at least be listening to their voice.
Is this also a problem for Democrats who might be trying to play the long game? As you mentioned, rural voters feel like they are, quote, left behind by Democrats in particular. In some cases, particularly statewide races, candidates for both parties. But what happens to Democrats if they continually don't spend time in those communities? What's the impact on a community like Mojave County?
Well, I think Mojave County is a really good example of that, because the way Mr. Tunnell explained it to me was he thinks there's a lot of would-be Democrats out there who just haven't been given a reason to trust a candidate enough to maybe consider that party platform. So the long-term loss is the potential to attract not just new voters to the party, but to hold the trust of pre-existing Democrats in those areas. When you consistently ignore people and the issues that matter to them in those areas, in particular water and property rights and the importance in their lives that those issues play, you continue this perception, be it a misperception or not, that the Democrats just don't care about rural everyday folks, you know, the small business owners and the ranchers. And I think that's something you've seen across the country. We've heard a lot of reporters, national reporters, kind of parachuting into communities like these and talking to, you know, the voters who supported President Trump, for example. And you can hear the distrust of city candidates. You can hear the distrust of Democratic elites and people who they perceive, they being the voters, as disconnected from your average everyday citizen who maybe chooses a different lifestyle that happens to be away from the city sprawl.
Right. We read a lot about flyover country when we talk about, you know, the rural, urban, Republican, Democrat divide in the country. Is it almost like flyover counties here in Arizona?
Absolutely, I think so. It's a little different once you get on the ground and you're talking about legislative candidates, because obviously they're living in those districts, or maybe not obviously, but presumably they're living in those districts. They understand their neighbors, so then, you know, they're paying attention to local issues because those are their issues. But for the statewide candidates, it's not familiar territory in a lot of ways, again, especially for the Democrats. So they bypass those areas because it can be difficult to speak extensively about water policy. It can be difficult to really truly understand property right concerns and issues with the federal government. I spoke to Democratic consultant Chad Campbell, who's also a former legislator, and the example he gave me is definitely a microcosm of what I'm talking about, but it was, I think, a really great example of the importance of understanding that rural perspective. He's a big proponent of the Mexican Gray Wolf Reintroduction Program, and he had always been like, yeah, we need to do this, even though he's not super fond of how the feds kind of approach it. But he never really understood the opposition until he went out with Arizona Game and Fish to a reintroduction area and got to know the ranchers there and the small business owners who had had issues with the reintroduction program and with the unintended negative consequences of that program. And just spending a couple of days with them and seeing it from their perspective really changed his view, not only of that issue, but also of rural issues in general. It may not have changed his opinion of the program, but it did give him an appreciation for how those folks live or why they take a different stance on issues as opposed to their urban counterparts.
It gave me a different perspective and a different appreciation for some of the local feeling about the program itself and about, you know, it was so much more than just, you know, cattle versus wolves. Mm-hmm. It was a really complex situation with federal government action and state and local and all kinds of different things
right.
that had been going on for, you know, decades and decades up there. And it was frustrating to a lot of the people. So it gave me a very interesting perspective on that issue. Mm-hmm. And it didn't change my position. I still to this day think that the Wolf Reintroduction Program is vital and important and should be implemented and expanded, honestly. But it gave me an appreciation for the complexity of it
right.
and why we need to listen to everybody being impacted and work to mitigate the negative consequences of that program.
Chad last held office a couple of years ago, but is there any Democrat or any Republican among the statewide candidates who you heard praise for as far as taking the time to go out and be in these communities? Is anybody doing it right?
Not from what I've heard. Chad Campbell, you know, he kind of had some kind thoughts for Kyrsten Sinema, basically saying she's trying to take a more crossover approach. I should also say Campbell is a pretty staunch supporter of Sinema, so of course he wants us to think nice things about her. But he does have a point. She is trying to appeal to a wider range of voters than, say, David Garcia. The comparison there is that Garcia has put all of his eggs into the new voters basket and the increased turnover model basket, and we're just not seeing that work out. So he might have been one of those candidates that could have benefited from even putting some time or some more time into really having some good, hard conversations with some rural voters to try to get them to see his perspective and see that he's not just some city guy coming in to represent a state like Arizona. I will say, even though her name wasn't brought up that much while I was talking to sources, Kathy Hoffman made a real go of trying to get out to rural communities. That doesn't necessarily mean she connected with those communities. There is a huge difference between, you know, going out there and putting on the cowboy hat or walking down the dirt road and saying, I'm here, and really understanding what they need. But she actually, you know, she made the effort, and we saw that in the primary results against David Shapira. While he seemed to have pretty easily claimed Phoenix and Tucson, she had tons of support in the surrounding areas. So that's a good example of how that strategy can pay off. On the Republican side, again, I'm not sure anyone's done a particularly good job of this. The Republican values maybe resonate more in Mojave County, so you automatically get votes for the sake of having that R next to your name, but that's not always the case in those areas. It goes beyond the D or the R or whatever next to your name, and it really gets down to who is going to help my family, who's going to help my neighbors, and who's going to make sure my community thrives.
Sounds like the overarching message here for candidates is don't take those votes for granted. When we come back, we'll talk to Carmen about President Trump making a stop in Arizona, and we'll also hear about a interesting candidate that goes by the name of Homie.
Did you know that according to the Arizona Department of Health Services, 1,544 Arizonans died from opioid overdoses in just the last 13 months? Of those that died from fatal overdose, 39% involved prescription opioids and no other drugs. Be sure to take opioids only as directed and talk to your doctor about other pain management options. Visit Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona's page, mobilizeaz.com, to learn more.
Welcome back to The Breakdown. I'm your guest host, Ben Giles, and I'm turning now to Carmen Forman to talk about the event of the season that happened Friday night, President Trump's visit to Mesa to stump for Martha McSally and Governor Doug Ducey. Now, before we jump in, full disclosure on this, we recorded this episode Friday morning, as is our usual practice. You're probably listening, hopefully please listening, Monday morning. So we're going to talk about what we expected at the time, and if anything super unexpected happened. I'm sure you can check out Carmen's story all about it on our website at azcapitaltimes.com. Anyways, Carmen, what did you expect out of the rally? Any curveballs, anything different from the president, or just sort of the usual?
Well, Ben, I think it's hard to know what to expect from a presidential visit because Trump sort of likes to keep his audience on their toes. Obviously, U.S. Senate candidate Martha McSally and Governor Doug Ducey will both be at the rally, and Trump is trying to drum up support for them and trying to galvanize Republicans ahead of the midterm elections. So he's probably going to give a very impassioned, very fiery speech. Again, because we're recording this first thing Friday morning, there's no telling what he will come up with.
Just the other day, Thursday of this week / last week for you listeners, we heard the president brag about a congressman who body slammed a reporter. What does that tell you going into Friday's rally?
President Trump's Thursday rally reminded all of us press people out there that we're still, quote unquote, the enemy of the people. But it's interesting that Trump's visit comes at a time when early voting has already started. And Data Orbital put out a poll on Friday that showed Kyrsten Sinema surging in the polls. And so it makes it pretty clear why Martha McSally wanted President Trump to come stump for her. She wants him to rally the base, get the base out, get them to support her, to head to the polls, to tell their five friends or their 50 family members to all go out and support Martha McSally. The interesting thing about the poll is that Data Orbital polled right after the single U.S. Senate debate in which Martha McSally and Kyrsten Sinema had quite the fiery verbal fight. And so the poll shows Sinema surging as early ballots start to come in and after her performance at the debate.
You know, it took you a couple of days to pry any information out of the Ducey campaign about whether or not the governor would even participate in the rally. I think the rally was announced pretty early last week, and maybe 48, 72 hours later, you heard from the governor's office. What's up with that?
So we knew that Governor Doug Ducey was going to appear with Trump at some point in time, whether it meant greeting him on the tarmac at the airport when he arrived, or if it meant him showing up at the rally. He was going to do something. And as the governor recently pointed out to me, just a few days after he was first inaugurated into office, he met President Barack Obama on the tarmac at Sky Harbor Airport because the president was coming to town and Governor Ducey felt it was his responsibility to greet him. But the question that many were asking was, would Ducey show up at a campaign rally, at a Make America Great Again rally? And his campaign has said yes, he will be there. He'll provide brief remarks, you know, maybe 3-5 minutes. Ultimately, it really shouldn't affect Ducey in the race at all. People know he's already been endorsed by Trump. People have seen Ducey travel to the White House multiple times this year. Him showing up on a campaign stage really isn't going to have much effect on Ducey's campaign. One, because Ducey is up by double-digit numbers. I think his campaign is fairly comfortable with their position at this point in the race. The only way I could see it really, really hurting Ducey is if, this is like my worst-case scenario, that if Donald Trump says something about, like, let's say something disparaging about the late Senator John McCain, and he puts both Martha McSally and Doug Ducey in a very awkward position of, do you speak out against President Trump or do you defend John McCain? You know, that sort of thing. But barring anything drastic or crazy at the event tonight, I think the governor's race will just continue as normal. You'll see Democrats who will criticize the governor for going to the rally tonight. And I'm sure we'll hear that up until Election Day. But in the long run, meh.
We always hear a lot of talk about the potential kiss of death of a Trump endorsement or a visit to a state to stump for a candidate, especially like in a primary race. I mean, he supported a few candidates very strongly earlier this year who ultimately lost various special elections across the country. What makes Ducey different, though? Why does he seem to be impervious to that Trump effect?
Ducey's got that cash money to make people forget about the Trump effect. No, that's really just a part of it. The real answer is it's partly Ducey. It's partly David Garcia in that who David Garcia is running as a candidate. It's partly that Doug Ducey has the incumbency factor. He hasn't done anything totally egregious in the past 4 years. I mean, some people might disagree with me there and cite, say, like the teacher walkout or the Uber incident or the Theranos incident. But ultimately, Ducey has been able to rise above national politics in his reelection bid. And some of that also has to do with the position he's running for. Take, for example, Martha McSally. She would work, if she were elected to the U.S. Senate, she would work directly with President Trump rather often. They would be voting on legislation that Trump could be pushing or advocating for. But out here in Arizona, we're a long way from Washington, D.C. And in reality, the governor of Arizona doesn't have a large amount of interaction with the president and his administration. Now, Ben, there was one quote-unquote candidate Trump did not drum up support for when he was here, and that was Homey. I assume that most of our listeners by now know that Homey is not a person, but rather a sales pitch. Can you tell me a little bit about what exactly Homey is?
Homey's a real estate company. It's a Utah-based company that's trying to emerge into the Phoenix market. It's a digital real estate company, and they have taken advantage of a bit of an election season loophole in which basically cities and towns can't treat political signs, or they can't treat any sign during campaign season different than the way they treat political signs. Most cities have their own ordinances for the slew of signs that you might normally see on right-of-ways and at intersections. You know, flip your house, we'll buy your car, whatever it might be. There are rules for that, city to city. But during election season, those rules are superseded by a state law that allows political candidates and et cetera to post signs pretty much wherever they please. And as many as they please. That's why you could drive down a city block and see 15 signs for one particular candidate. And then there's a Supreme Court ruling that comes into play here, a 2015 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court, that is, which essentially said that you can't treat signs differently based on content. And what that means is when the state law is applied during campaign season, it might particularly identify political signs as what the state law is providing some more leeway for, but all other signs get to be treated with the same leeway. Thus, you have a bunch of these teal signs around town, a couple of billboards too, actually, that urge you to vote Homie for Senate and go to the website. And that's when you learn, okay, this isn't actually a candidate for U.S. Senate. This is just a real estate advertising pitch.
I'm not going to lie. I saw the signs when I was driving to work. And don't judge me. I frantically Googled it while I was stopped at a stoplight. And I didn't have enough time to read the website, so I was a little confused. I thought Homie was a real person. Are others just as confused as I am on this issue?
Yeah, it's kind of a dense campaign. We spoke with PR guru Jason Rose, who actually ran a similar campaign in a previous election cycle. From an economic standpoint, he said this is a great idea because it's pretty cheap to buy a bunch of signs in rebar and post them around town. It's a lot less expensive than paying for a bunch of billboards or renting ad space on a bus stop or whatever heck else you might advertise on at a street corner. But he did criticize the fact that it's very subtle. And the interesting thing about it is it doesn't actually have to be that subtle. They could post a sign directly about, hey, check out our real estate company. And still, nobody could take it down because that's the loophole. That's the way the law works. The content of the sign right now does not matter. And that's just the guidance that cities and towns get from attorneys at the Arizona League of Cities and Towns. They feel like there's not much we can do about it, at least until 15 days after the election, which is the deadline for everybody to get these signs the heck off your streets. And we can all just drive a little bit more peacefully after that.
So it's very subtle, and you obviously wrote a story trying to explain what this is. Do you feel like you got hosed at all? Because the real estate company was essentially sort of fishing for press coverage?
Yeah, guilty as charged. That's my bad, everybody. I recognize that this is one of those earned media situations where if it's so subtle, they are trying to get folks' attention. They are trying to get people to write about it. I think I wrote that story on Monday last week, and I was one of three different news outlets to cover it. And by Tuesday morning, I was talking about it on the radio. And that's when the real estate company finally decided, okay, we'll weigh in too now, because mission accomplished. You got my attention, Homie. For anyone who is bothered by that, I am deeply sorry for your loss.
You win some, you lose some, I guess.
But you know, you always win when you're listening to The Breakdown.
That is glass half full Katie Campbell right there. Thank you so much for that positivity to end the Weird Homie podcast on. Thanks again for joining us, listeners, this week. We always appreciate having you tune into this, I'll remind you one more time, award-winning podcast. Hell yeah. Anyway, we'll be back next week with more political coverage from the state capitol and beyond. Thanks again for joining us on The Breakdown.